Word this morning is found in Matthew 6, 19 through 20, 22. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasure in heaven, where moths and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The end of the word for today. Ask the blessing. Pastor comes.
Thank you, Glenn. Occurred to me, I asked Rick if we had any updates for the actual building process, and it didn't occur to me till just now to touch base with him until this morning about that. Do we have any updates that we need to let people know about the building process? So we need a few variances on the zoning laws that are in place, and that meeting is tomorrow night. So if you want to be in prayer about process, that's the next step. All right. How can I gain anything of lasting value? Jesus just told me to store up treasure in heaven in Matthew chapter 6. I want to store up treasure in heaven. Seems like a good idea. Treasure in heaven is better than trinkets on earth, right? Things of earth, they're small, they're passing away, but what God gives is fantastic and it endures eternally. So we should not be focused on what is temporary, but on what is forever. This seems like a good kind of trade-off. We'll trade away the temporary to gain the eternal. We'll trade away that which fades in value to that which lasts and grows in value. This is good. We should not invest for this life only, but focus on the life that never ends. We need to lay up treasure in heaven. Jesus tells me to. I want to do it. How is it done? What can I do in this life that would be of any eternal value? What can I offer to God that He would treasure? I know how to invest in this world. I can go to the bank. I can start a savings account. Many of us have opened retirement accounts. We know how to invest in the things of this world, but where can I go to purchase eternal investments? Does heaven have a brokerage firm? We can figure out how to set up an IRA, right? The individual retirement account. How does one set up an IEA? That is the individual eternity account. How is that possible? How is it done? Does the kingdom of heaven even recognize the American dollar as a legitimate exchange currency? How do I invest in eternity? We need to perhaps rethink what we value. In Matthew 6, Jesus was not asking people for their money. As though he were some sort of first century televangelist, he was not asking people for their money. His pitch was not, don't invest in your business, give your money to me and God will bless you. That's not Jesus' pitch. Jesus was not saying, hey, your money will triple if you only give lots and lots of it to me. Nor did he say, every dollar that you invest with me will be returned to you 1,000% interest in the kingdom of heaven. Give me $1,000 now and you'll be an eternal millionaire. That was not what Jesus said. Instead, Jesus, in these verses, he's calling for a reordering of our values. Let me put it this way so we understand. Jesus was not telling us to exchange an earthly form of greed and covetousness to gain a spiritual heavenly form of greed and covetousness. He certainly was not giving investment advice about how to get rich in this life. In fact, in verse 24, Jesus actually warns directly about the great danger and temptation of earthly riches. Instead, what he's trying to do is reorder how we think, to break our patterns of greed altogether and get our eyes off of what truly does not last and is not ultimately important, and to put our eyes on what does last and what is important that is not driven by our covetousness and our greed. He wants us to turn from the dusty, dismal, dying patterns of earth and to cast our attention to the kingdom that fulfills us and lasts forever. He wants us to become a different kind of people. A kind of people who are not greedy. A kind of people who build something lasting with our lives. But how can we do that? How can we use our lives for things that truly do endure? Things that truly do make a difference? And that's a very hard question, because we know how to invest in this world, but it's so much harder to know what matters for the next. That's what we're going to talk about today. How do we build something that lasts forever? What can we invest in that will yield eternal dividends? How can we please God and lay up treasure in heaven in the way he asks us to do it? Well, I want to begin by turning in our Bibles all the way back to 2 Chronicles. You didn't see that one coming, did you? 2 Chronicles, start in chapter 2, and then we'll go to chapter 7. And we're going to think about the temple that Solomon builds. You see, David had commissioned his son, King Solomon, to build a temple for God. And the image, the desire, was for this temple to be truly spectacular. And in this, we acknowledge God is worth our best efforts. God is worth it. We would not be giving too much to God when we give everything to him. And yet, how can we possibly offer God anything that he actually deserves? In 2 Chronicles 2, verses 5 and 6, Solomon is putting into words in a letter to a neighboring king. He's putting into words some thoughts that he has about this building program. And he wonders about its value. He knew what he was building. He knew that what he was building was, relatively speaking, truly great. But he also knew that no matter how great it turned out to be, it was utterly inadequate to honor the God he served. So 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, Solomon says, "The temple I am going to build will be great because our God is greater than all other gods." And just pausing there for a second, we acknowledge Solomon had a good aspiration, right? Solomon had a good desire here. He wanted to do something glorious because God is glorious. God deserves our best efforts, and the temple was a best effort. It was great. It was a magnificent structure that really honestly made all other ancient temples look like outhouses. Right? And yet, how can that be enough? He goes on, "But who is able to build a temple for him? Since the heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain him. Who then am I to build a temple for him, except as a place to burn sacrifices before him?" Solomon is right. He could build the most impressive and showy building in the entire world, and it would be utterly inadequate. How do you build a temple for God? God is great and glorious. God is holy. He fills all of heaven and earth. He cannot be contained. He cannot be controlled. He is in every way beyond us. On the next clear night, go out and look up. Take a few moments and learn again the humility that comes standing before the infinite variety and beauty that is above us. Recognize that the God we serve made it all. He hung those stars in space. He knows them by name, and he is beyond them. 14 billion light years across is our universe that we've measured so far. God is beyond it. God is bigger than that. So how can we build a temple on earth that's going to be worthy of the God who made all of that? How? What temple? Even if it were to be as big as the whole world and made of solid gold, what temple could possibly impress God? So how much less of a chance do we have? And I'm talking we here at New Buffalo Alliance. I wonder, by now, hopefully you've gathered the fact that we are starting a building program. Hopefully you've gathered the fact that we are starting a building campaign to build that. We've chosen this phrase, foundation for ministry, as a slogan, a shorthand of what we are doing. It's a foundation because it's a starting point. That is, from here, we're using this expansion, we wish to become a greater tool in the hands of the Holy Spirit. It's a foundation because we have only just begun the work that God has called this church to do. The last 40 years have not been enough. We're going to do more. And that's why we've chosen the word ministry as well. The reason to build is that our current ministries are thriving. We are rapidly outgrowing our facilities. We need greater and more versatile space. Our success in ministry to this point is driving our desire to build. And we don't want to limit what we are doing because of the church building that might be getting in the way of the growth and expansion of those ministries. We are convinced that if we build this space, we will be providing a foundation for expanded and growing ministry at the present time and into the future. But it's no secret, we're not building Solomon's Temple. Anybody who expects Solomon's Temple to be put on the back of this building is going to be sadly disappointed. What we are going to build is not going to be Notre Dame. It will not measure up to the Crystal Cathedral or St. Peter's Basilica. We have a much more practical, useful design. Hopefully not ugly by any means, but not showy either. It won't set the architectural world abuzz by the wonder of what we're doing. It won't bring about world peace. It will not cause Democrats and Republicans to get along. Compared to the rest of the world, what we build will be microscopic. Compared to God, well, what difference will it make at all? Can it be enough? Could God possibly be impressed? Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? It's hardly close to being the temple, and there was no reason for God to even be impressed by the temple. So would God be impressed by what we do? I think the answer is not innately no. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be important. I mean, why should we, those of us here at New Buffalo in Pennsylvania, why should we think that this addition would store up treasure in heaven? Why should we think that this addition would build something lasting? Why should we think that this will change the world? It's at this point that we should remember something rather important. We must remember that what matters is not what we can accomplish, but what God chooses to do. Solomon could only build so much. He knew it wasn't enough. God honored it anyway. This is where we turn to 2 Chronicles 7. We begin in verse 11. I'm going to skip a few verses in here. I hope you can follow along. In verse 11, it says, when Solomon had finished the temple of the Lord, that is that inadequate thing that he knew wasn't good enough for God. When Solomon finished it, it says then, the Lord appeared to him at night and said, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a temple for sacrifices. And we go on to the next in verse 16, I believe it is. It says, now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayers offered in this place. I have chosen and consecrated this temple so that my name may be there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. There's no reason that the temple of Solomon would impress God. By our standards, it was big. By our standards, it was beautiful, well-designed. But it could never be beautiful enough, big enough, well-designed enough to impress God and force him to move in, to dwell there. But God did. God did not bless Israel and dwell in the temple because Solomon made the temple good enough for him. No, God chose to dwell there and use that temple because he is a gracious God, because he is a loving God, abounding in kindness toward his people. Nothing compelled him to do it. He chose to do it. And so, I am convinced it will be with us. We want the work we do on this structure and the money that's given for its construction and the ministry that we attempt to do in it. We want all of that to be treasures stored up in heaven, bearing spiritual dividends throughout eternity. But that result would not be because our work is good enough. Like Solomon, we recognize that in a very extremely important way, our work will never be good enough. And yet we also recognize that what matters to God is not really the part that impresses other people. This world, people around us, oftentimes us, we can be fixated upon size, upon beauty, upon fiscal cost or fiscal frugality, the workmanship that's put into something and so on. But God is not captured by those things. God's attention is captured by the heart of his children. Anyone who has had young children knows this and understands it. So imagine with me for a moment a young girl. She's only about 3 years old, which is a great age for a daughter. 3 years old, it's that precocious age of being able to speak and draw and walk. And yet, it's that age that is still very much a young child, and who knows what's going to come out of the mouth of the one that can speak and walk and draw. She pours herself into a project. I mean, she has spent whole minutes of her life on this project. And if you know three-year-olds, that's a long time. I mean, I guess, relatively speaking, as a percentage of her life, it really is a long time. But in any case, she has been coloring on this sheet of paper for a long time, and then she runs to her father. And she puts that paper in her father's lap, and she smiles in a way that causes the sun to rise upon the heart of that father. You understand what I'm saying? Maybe you've been there. And then she says, "I colored this for you, Daddy." Or whatever the three-year-old sounds like. And he looks at it. It's beautiful. There are a few blobs on it. And one of those blobs looks like it has what might be legs. You know? "Oh, how special," says the father. "Is that an octopus?" "Daddy, that's a unicorn." "Of course. And that's me, and that's you. I made this so that you can always see it and always be happy. I love you, Daddy." Tell me, is the father happy? Why? Is he happy because that picture is a work of art? Because it's on a parallel with a Picasso or a Rembrandt or a Monet? No? Of course not. He can't even tell that this unicorn's a unicorn. It looks like an octopus. By that standard, by the standard of a Picasso or a Monet or a Rembrandt, he would be disgusted and cast away the picture, declaring it to be entirely inadequate. But the father doesn't do that. Of course not. In fact, he's never beheld a work of art more precious to him. He values it. Why? Well, because he loves the child, and the child loves him, and the child did this for him because she loves him. You do see where I'm going with this, right? We do not lay up treasure in heaven by the greatness of what it is that we have to offer God. Building the biggest church structure the world has ever seen is not something that makes God impressed. Giving huge amounts of money will never put God in our debt. Attempting great things for God is good. It's not bad. But let's not fool ourselves into thinking that our wisdom, our strength, our abilities, the riches that we have, or our efforts that we to build something is what is going to build heavenly wealth. What matters is not the greatness of our working, but the goodness of our God. I want to say that again. What matters is not the greatness of our working, but the goodness of our God. What matters to God is not the results of his children's work, but the hearts of his children who offer the work. God loves what kind of giver? A cheerful giver. It doesn't measure our gift by the amount, but by the heart. He wants us to be generous people. The way to store up treasure in heaven is not by accomplishing something brilliant on the outside, or by our own genius coming up with something that is universe-changing. Treasure in heaven is built as we offer our failing, faltering, comically inadequate drawings of octopus unicorns to God out of a heart of love. We want to build something lasting. We desire to lay a foundation for ministry. What do we mean by that? Well, as we've said, foundation involves a beginning. There is more to come. The whole of our effort does not begin and end with giving to build a new addition to our church. That's a mere place to start, a place to build from. We have ministry we are doing and desire to expand. We have new ministries in mind that we want to build, but it starts from this new place. It's a foundation. A foundation also implies a strong and lasting structure. Jesus talked about two very different types of houses in the next chapter in Matthew 7. One is built without foundation. The other had a strong foundation upon bedrock. And one day the storm comes on both. The rain falls, the streams rise, the wind blows and beat against both houses in the same way. But the house on the rock remained, while the house on sand fell, and great was its ruin. What's the difference? The sure foundation. As we build, we desire to build with a firm foundation that will endure and allow us to thrive through trials. And honestly, obviously, we're going to have footers dug. We're going to have lots of concrete poured in this building. A large building needs a large foundation, but that's not my point. My point is, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain that build it. Our first task in this work is to rely upon the Lord our God. From first to last, our eyes must be on him. Otherwise, we have no firm foundation. Ministry implies we seek to do good work. The point of the church is the point of this is not to have the church be a bigger building. Certainly not. The point is not for us to own more or to point at some great thing that we can do, an edifice to raise our own glory. Heaven forbid. Instead, we want a tool to use for the glory of God. We want to do more work, more outreach, more discipleship. Ministry implies that to whom much is given, much will be required, and we acknowledge that we have been given much and have much to offer also. We're not called to change the world, but we are called to be faithful and know that great effects in this world do come from small faithfulness. What we want to build is, honestly speaking, small. Whether we offer God loaves and fishes or the Temple of Solomon, ultimately what we offer to God is small and not really ultimately worth his time, if we're going to be objective about it. But what lasts is not of our doing, but the world-changing miracles of God through what it is that we offer. Will what we do change the world? Will our investment of time and money pay off and build something great, something that is truly lasting? Yes, but not because we do it. Like the kingdom, we measure the payoff of an investment over generations, not by immediate results. God's work throughout the Bible starts small and grows to larger things. It's how it always has happened. God chose one man, Abram, with his goal of blessing the whole world. He started with one guy. In Daniel 2, there's a dream of a huge statue, and that statue represents the evil kingdoms of this world. It seems strong. It seems imposing. It looks like something that could never end, never be destroyed. But then a stone starts rolling off of a mountain. A stone that starts small, but it hits the statue and it grinds the statue, those evil kingdoms of the world, it grinds them to fine powder, while the stone itself grows to be a mountain that fills the earth. That's the kingdom of God. It's how it's always worked. Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is like a seed or a bit of yeast. It starts small, but it grows, it thrives, it begins to influence everything, and it changes the world. It begins in Jerusalem, it spreads to Judea and Samaria, and eventually reaches the uttermost parts of the earth. And you know where the ends of the earth are, right? Here. You don't get much further away from Jerusalem than Duncannon, Pennsylvania. It continues to spread. What we do here at New Buffalo Alliance is, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, rather small. We might legitimately wonder if God can take this and use it, if we can offer God anything of truly significant or lasting impact. But this is how the kingdom grows. We do our part. We do the small thing in the faithful way God has asked us to do it, and God does the rest. We will build something that outlasts ourselves if we are faithful. We will build something that grows more powerful over time, something that echoes down through the generations and in the hands of God, changes far more of this world than we could dream. Solomon's temple did not last. The people became unfaithful. The temple was destroyed and the people went into exile in Babylon. 70 years later, Israel came back to Jerusalem from exile and they began to build a new temple. It was not the same. The new temple was small, just a fraction of the size of Solomon's temple. Haggai, the prophet, even said that those who looked at the new temple and remembered the old temple, wept because it looked like nothing at all. But God, through the prophet Haggai, encouraged his people. What matters is not the size of the temple, but the size of the God the people serve. Another prophet of that same time, Zechariah, also saw the new temple was small. And he said this, "Do not despise the day of small beginnings." Because what matters is not our work, but the work of God. He takes the pitiful octopus unicorns that we offer him, and he creates the masterpiece in time. What we do is fading and faltering. What God does is take our weak offering and make it last forever. We give what is small, God makes it big. If we faithfully use what we are given, our time, our resources, our money, our talent, God will take the effort and change the world. It can seem small in our eyes. God makes it big. That's what he's always been doing. Throughout the Bible, he uses people who are faithful, and they are world changers. God is looking always for world changers. But that rarely looks like important stuff to us. But God knows what really changes the world. His plan is for seeds and yeast. He wants loaves and fish. What's it look like? Well, be a mother who raises small children in a faithful way. Do you know the world-changing impact of a mother who faithfully raises her children? Do you know it? Is she really less important than a businesswoman who achieves a career as a doctor or a lawyer? Of course not. It's not to talk down to women who have careers, of course not, but it is to say, plant a tree and bless the next generation. You yourself may not eat the fruit, but it will produce for generations. Be a teacher. Faithfully teach children that the same Jesus who loved children loves them too. We think that small. We think that not very noteworthy in the eyes of the world. But a faithful teacher changes the world. I know I've had teachers change my world. Perhaps you have as well. Be a father who provides and sets a quiet example of faithful love. Such a man changes the world in countless ways. Be a good and honest businessman, one who is reliable and trustworthy, who inspires confidence in those around him and in those he may employ. Reach out to your neighbors. Be hospitable. Be a good friend. Be loving. Be like Jesus. You don't need to preach to everyone, but you can reach too. And this changes the world. Do good for others. Be helpful and generous. It may not be something that makes you rich, but it builds a greater wealth. Every Christmas we watch that movie, right? To my big brother George, the richest man in town. Well, he almost, you know, lost everything because of like 5,000 bucks. Was he really the richest guy in town? Yeah, it's the legacy of goodness in his life. Invest in the gospel. Speak it. Know it. Let it transform you. Let it speak to the hearts of others. Give to missions. Build the ministry of the church through effort and through giving. Does it seem small in your eyes, what you can offer? Do not despise the day of small things. We want to build. You are invited to help. Whether your part is large or small, and relatively speaking, it's your part. And God will use it. It will grow. And it will be one way that you can lay up treasure in heaven while we do not neglect every other way. And this brings us back to Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21. The investments of earth can be very short-sighted. There are inherent risks, moth and rust and thieves, a questionable stock market. There are, at times, short-term benefits. Riches, maybe. Homes, comforts, luxuries, perhaps. But there are always long-term losses, and we must measure everything we do in this world with that in mind. The richest man on earth is unable to take a single dollar with him out of this world and into the next. Why would we suffer for so many years for riches we must leave to others? We need to reorient our priorities. The long-term investments of heaven are much better and certain. There are no risks there, no moth or rust or thieves, and no risky stock market. Of course, you might lose short-term gratification, but you gain an investment that pays off eternally. And what payoff? Not greedy gain. We gain God. Because we go to him with our octopus unicorns and he smiles upon us. And then we get to, with joy, see what he does with what we offer. So offer your octopus unicorns and see what God can do.